This morning, our speaker is Jill Austin. Jill is former chair of UUFM, and she now serves as worship committee chair. Jill is department chair of the Department of Management at MTSU, and she teaches courses in leadership and ethics. Jill will speak on the topic, Spring and the Seventh UU Principle. Let's welcome Jill.
Good morning. I'll begin today's talk with a poem by Mary Oliver. It describes the joy of spring. The poem is called Such Singing in the Wild Branches. It was spring, and I finally heard him among the first leaves. Then I saw him clutching the limb in an island of shade with his red-brown feathers all trim and neat for the new year. First, I stood still and thought of nothing. Then I began to listen. Then I was filled with gladness. And that's when it happened, when I seemed to float, to be myself, a wing or a tree. And I began to understand what the bird was saying. And the sands in the glass stopped. And for a pure white moment, while gravity sprinkled upward like rain rising, and in fact, it became difficult to tell just what it was that was singing. It was the thrush for sure, but it seemed not a single thrush, but himself and all his brothers, and also the trees around them, as well as the gliding long-tailed clouds in the perfectly blue sky. All of them were singing. And of course, yes, so it seemed, so was I. Such soft and solemn and perfect music doesn't last for more than a few moments. It's one of those magical places wise people like to talk about. One of the things they say about it that is true is that once you've been there, you're there forever. Listen, everyone has a chance. Is it spring? Is it morning? Are there trees near you? And does your own soul need comforting? Quick then, open the door and fly on your heavy feet. The song may already be drifting away. Spring is my favorite time of year. I expect it's a favorite season for many of us. Everything is growing around us. The darkness and death of winter is gone, and we have new life. We have more sun, more daylight. We're beginning to see forsythia, daffodils, tulips, flowering trees, green onions. Things are growing everywhere we look. The vibrant, beautiful colors wake us up and tell us we're alive. And all around us is life. There's an energy and a happiness about this time of year. Some of my spring remembrances from childhood and early adulthood include things like walking around the maypole during kindergarten, picking daffodils, playing tennis during the blustery days of March and April, celebrating that first Earth Day in 1970 by planting pine trees, and planting a garden with my grandfather. I suppose those memories also are part of my anticipation of spring. And of course, there are new memories to make. In the Northern Hemisphere, spring occurs during the months of March, April, and May, or from the vernal equinox, March 20th, to the summer solstice, June 21st. Of course, the opposite is true for the Southern Hemisphere. During that first day of spring, which is today, there's supposed to be 12 hours of sunlight and 12 hours of night. In spring, the Earth's axis is tilted toward the sun, increasing the number of daylight hours and also bringing warmer weather. During this time, we see flowers and plants begin to grow, leaves bud on the trees, animals shed their winter coats, and birds lay their eggs. We also get to deal with severe weather in the form of tornadoes this time of year due to the warm air moving up from the lower latitudes and the cold air pushing down from the north. Here are a couple of fun facts about spring. The idea that it is possible to balance an egg on its end on the spring equinox is a myth. Trying to balance an oval-shaped object on its end is no easier on the spring equinox than any other day. According to tradition, if a groundhog does not see his shadow after emerging from his burrow on Groundhog Day, which is February 2nd, spring will come early. If he sees his shadow, winter will last for 6 more weeks. Groundhog Day has its roots in the Celtic festival of Imbolc, also February 1st and 2nd, which marks a seasonal turning point. Another fun fact, the term spring fever refers to both psychological and physiological symptoms associated with the arrival of spring, including a general restlessness and maybe a little daydreaming. While the exact cause is unclear, scientists believe that increased light, more exercise, and more bare skin influence our hormone levels. So spring fever may be a real thing. Another fun fact, children actually grow faster in the spring than other times of the year. I don't know if that's true. It was on the internet. Every year, on the first day of spring, people in Poland gather to burn an effigy and throw it in the river to bid winter farewell. I wonder if this Polish tradition is related to the pagan celebration of Beltane on May 1st, and maybe to the green man, the pagan nature spirit of vegetation that symbolizes that life is found in the earth. The green man is typically portrayed as a human face surrounded by dense foliage. Such images appear as far back as the 11th century in church carvings. As Christianity spread, the green man went into hiding, with stonemasons leaving secret images of his face around cathedrals and churches. Incorporating a green man into the design of a medieval church or cathedral was a kind of small act of faith on the part of the carver that life and fresh crops will return to the soil each spring and that the harvest will be plentiful. Another fun fact, according to Greek myth, the return of spring coincides with the return of Persephone, the daughter of Demeter, who is the goddess of plants and fertility. You all know that there are a number of holidays and observances that occur during the spring season. We have Easter, Passover, Earth Day, the vernal equinox, Ostara, Arbor Day, May Day, Beltane, the Baha'i New Year, the Hindu New Year. It's always interesting to me how many similarities there are in different religions for holidays during various seasons of the year. All of these observances we're talking about now are about newness and rebirth in some way. Okay, so now that we've caught up sufficiently on all things spring, let's move on to the point of today's talk. Let's explore our need for connection with nature. Many people feel a strong connection to the earth and to nature. These people would say their interaction with nature is a spiritual activity that nurtures them and makes them whole people. Aristotle said, "In all things of nature, there is something marvelous." Some of the oldest forms of religious expression can be described as pagan. A primary characteristic of pagan religions is a reverence for nature. Many ancient civilizations and indigenous peoples developed their own earth-centered religious traditions. Examples include Celtic, Norse, American Indian, Egyptian, Central American, and Caribbean traditions. Most of the Eastern religions are also considered pagan. Pagans see the divine in nature. They are in awe of nature. They love the energy of the earth, the heat of the sun, the mystery of the moon. Some pagans worship deities while others concentrate on the energy that is found in nature. Without getting into the specific beliefs of any of the different types of paganism, a few examples should illustrate my point that many people feel a strong connection between the earth or nature and spirituality. Consider Native American culture. A deep reverence for nature is at the heart of Native American spirituality. An important theme is honoring Mother Earth and coexisting with nature and animals. The idea is that all of nature is intertwined. Ed McGaugh, who is also known as Eagle Man, said, "The rainbow symbolizes spirit of life, and from the rainbow little flames of knowledge fall. Where they land, flowers grow." Native Americans understand their spirituality in terms of oneness. They believe they are one with the Earth Mother, with the universe, and with each other. Another example of spirituality in nature can be seen in Mother Earth or Gaia. She is considered the sustainer of life and the mother of us all in some traditions. In some pagan beliefs, the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, have a special significance. They are the spiritual substance from which all things are made. We could use the word pantheism in this discussion also. This is the idea that God is the transcendent reality and human beings are just manifestations of that reality. In other words, God is identified with nature. God is nature. Pantheists may say that they would say that they revere nature, and they define the spiritual not as a supernatural, but as a sense of their place within the natural world. These examples illustrate that many belief systems include a significant relationship between the spiritual and the earth. Let's think for a moment about our own personal connection with the earth and how it impacts who we are. When we go out into the woods or even to a park or our own backyards, we are surrounded by nature, trees, animals, birds, rocks, grass, and water. There is a sense of holiness or quiet in nature if we will just stop and listen. Everything is alive and interconnected. These parts of nature, the trees, the dirt, the grass, the water, they're separate, but at the same time, they are part of a whole. Our nature-spirit connection becomes stronger if we will take the time to get immersed in nature. Take a walk in the woods, sit by a stream or river, and listen to the water sounds. Watch the swaying of the trees when the wind blows. Notice the beauty in the dark purple clouds before a thunderstorm. Look, really look at the beauty around us. Even in the wintertime, when everything is brown, there is a beauty in the yellow grasses, the white birch trees in the middle of other dark tree trunks in the woods, and also that bright blue winter sky. Get up early and watch the sunrise. Notice the colors in the clouds of a sunset. Feel the cold of a cave when outside it's 90 degrees. There are so many ways to practice the earth-spirit connection. Grow a garden. Plant a flower. Patricia Barnett suggests that simply stopping and looking at the beauty around us is like a prayer. May Sarton said, in the garden, the door is always open into the holy. An environmentalist named John Milton wrote, at an early age, it seemed absolutely obvious to me that the church of the earth was the greatest church of all, that the temple of the forest was the supreme temple. He said, when I went to the sanctuary of the mountain, I found earth's natural altar, Great Spirit's real shrine. And the Sufi mystic Rumi wrote this. He said, I am the dust in the sunlight. I am the ball of the sun. I am the mist of the morning, the breath of the evening. I am the spark in the stone, the gleam of gold in the metal, the rose and the nightingale drunk with its fragrance. I am the chain of being, the circle of spheres, the scale of creation, the rise and the fall. I am what is and is not. I am the soul in all. The Dalai Lama spoke about the earth-spirit connection this way. The earth is not only the common heritage of all humankind, but also the ultimate source of life. By overexploiting its resources, we are undermining the very basis of our own life. Therefore, the protection and conservation of the earth is not a question of morality or ethics, but it's a question of our survival. Let's think about how that spirit-nature connection impacts us every day. The admonition that we should stop and smell the roses is more than just a phrase. It reminds us that we must experience our connection with the earth from time to time. So how are we connected? There are so many ways. There's the cycle of life that we are part of. As that song says, we are stardust. And we impact the earth every day, for good or for bad, the way we live. The earth impacts us every day, whether for good or for bad, from sunburns to providing water for us to drink. Our spirit is nurtured by life, by nature, by the environment. Nature is essential to us. It reminds us of our connection with everything and everyone. The wonder of nature gives us a sense of awe, a reverence for life. Nature reminds us of the need for peace and contemplation. It helps to reduce our stress. It gives us pleasure. It gives us hope when we experience the beauty of new life in the spring and the strength of a flower growing through rocks on a hillside. Nature keeps us in the moment. It lessens our worry over work and life stresses. Nature is our teacher. As you know, our seventh principle says, we respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. This is our most recently added UU principle. Reverend James Ishmael Ford tells the story of the addition of the seventh principle this way. He says, finally, on June 25th, 1984, Unitarian Universalists from across the United States and Canada gathered at the Ohio State University campus in Columbus for the 11th General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. The great focus of this GA was a vote on a new statement of principles. When the document was pretty close to being finished, he said, it was frankly mostly mom and apple pie. There was hardly a word that anyone of almost any spiritual tradition could argue with. He said it was what I would call the perfect product of a committee. But he said its most distinctive feature was that first principle, a declaration of the inherent worth and dignity of every person. That was different. Then the Reverend Paul Lahure made his way to the microphones that day at the GA. People who remember the scene say he was lanky and bearded, and he stood at the microphone with the ease of an experienced pulpit minister. He looked around briefly, he stroked his beard, he addressed the proposed seventh principle, which called for, here's how it was worded, respect for the earth and the interdependence of its living systems. But then Paul proposed new wording for the seventh principle, a call to respect the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. Ford said, the GA delegates accepted the proposed change, and with that decision, that little band of UUs found itself marked with an astonishing power, a divine blessing aimed at healing this poor and broken world. So he felt like the first and the seventh principles really are critical and make us different as UUs. Reverend Ford says he calls himself a first and seventh principle preacher. He says, we need both principles, the dynamic of the one and the many, to ground our message. The first principle is about the one. The seventh is about the many. Ford said that the call of the individual in the first principle was a deep and true insight, but that it was missing something. He says that the seventh principle calls to the wisdom that is in our hearts about how and why the individual is precious. The knowledge that we are completely woven out of each other and the cosmos itself in a living song of intimacy is where we find our completeness. We are all connected. Ford called this edition of the seventh principle the new universalism, the new realization and understanding that all are chosen. So let me tell you a couple of things I found about the seventh principle that may help us think a little bit differently about it. Reverend Darcy Lane said this about the seventh principle. This is ours as you use, our covenant to affirm and promote respect for the interdependent web of which we are a part. It comes from both the lineage of science and the lineage of earth-centered traditions. This principle is now part of who we are. She said it's part of our tradition and heritage. It reminds us of our inherent unity with everything. It reminds us to think in terms of our relationships instead of our separateness. Molly Kahn, who's a UU pagan, said, at first glance, it all seems very simple. She said the seventh principle must be a product of the environmental movement and an acknowledgement of many UU's commitment to reducing our impact on the ecosystem. However, Kahn believes that to really live this principle, we must live our lives differently. We are born and raised largely unaware of our position in this web of all existence and how we impact it. Many people don't realize or acknowledge where our food comes from or where our water has traveled. Kahn says to be truly a part of this web of all life, we must step up and take that place of living differently. She asked these questions. Have we acknowledged the immense gifts that are being given to us? When we turn on the faucet and clean water pours out of the tap, where has that water come from? What have we done to respect that body of water? What have we given to ensure it's continuous? For this thing I'm doing or planning on doing, she says, ask this question. Who and what does it affect and how? Then Reverend Forrest Gilmore, the executive director of the Shalom Community Center, said this about the seventh principle. He said, our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence, is a glorious statement. Yet we make a profound mistake when we limit it to merely an environmental idea. He says it is so much more. It is our response to the great dangers of both individualism and oppression. It is our solution to the seeming conflict between the individual and the group. Gilmore says that this principle may be a way that UUs can fully embrace something greater than ourselves. He said, the interdependent web expressed as the spirit of life, the ground of all being, the oneness of all existence, the community-forming power, the process of life, the creative force, even God, can help us develop that social understanding of ourselves that we and our culture so desperately need. It is a source of meaning to which we can dedicate our lives, he said. So consider how you think of this seventh principle. Is it a blessing aimed at healing a broken world? Is it the other side of the first principle that calls us to consider both the one and the many? Is it a reminder that we're woven together with each other? Is it maybe a new kind of universalism? Is it a call to live differently? A solution to conflict of individualism and oppression? Is it a reminder to embrace something larger than ourselves? Well, maybe that seventh principle is all of these. You'll also remember that one of our six sources of Unitarian Universalism is spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. This source reminds us to live in harmony with nature and that the earth-based traditions can provide guidance for finding this harmony. Now for a couple of quotes about nature, spirit connection, from some well-known Unitarians. Henry David Thoreau said, "We need the tonic of wilderness. We can never have enough of nature. In wilderness is the preservation of the world." He also said, "An early morning walk is a blessing for the whole day." Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Adopt the pace of nature. Her secret is patience." And he also said, "The earth laughs in flowers." Our appreciation of nature helps us to find the harmony in our own lives. As you use, we understand the importance of practicing this spirit-nature connection. Our actions to appreciate and protect the environment makes a difference in the world, and it also feeds our spirits and makes our reverence for nature grow. Then we want to do more to keep the earth healthy. Not only do you use recognize the spirit-nature connection through our sources and our principles, we also celebrate that connection through our flower communion, our water communion, and our social justice environmental activities. Recognizing this connection is not a new one for any of us. I guess if you think about it, we recognized this connection when we were very young. We sang songs like "Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star," "How I Wonder What You Are," "Up Above the World So High, Like a Diamond in the Sky." We learned about nature in another song when we were kids. "The Itsy Bitsy Spider Went Up the Water Spout." "Down Came the Rain and Washed the Spider Out." "Out came the sun and dried up all the rain, and the itsy bitsy spider went up the spout again." And you still remember the hand signals as well. If I am to respect the interdependent web of all existence and live in harmony with nature, I want to do that by recognizing the wonder of the star and the water cycle of the earth that the spider had to contend with. I want to celebrate the beauty and the uniqueness of all nature around me. I want to appreciate the beauty of the land, the variety of different species of plants and animals, and the uniqueness of every separate snowflake. Because of the seventh principle, I want to find that place of earth-spirit connection that calls me to live differently, to embrace something larger than myself, to understand that we are woven together with each other. I hope today I've provided some information that maybe gives you a little bit more to think about related to the seventh principle. And I'll close with this, some lyrics from a song that I think illustrate this earth-spirit connection really well. Songwriter Peter Mayer reminds us that everything is holy now. Some lyrics from the song titled "Holy Now" are, "This morning outside I stood and saw a little red-winged bird, shining like a burning bush, singing like a scripture verse. It made me want to bow my head. Everything is holy now." You get the idea. We're all connected to the earth. It is a spiritual connection. It's up to us to find a way to develop and cherish that connection in a way that works for us and will be richer for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jill. We continue our stewardship drive through April the 10th. During the collection of gifts, we will be giving out stewardship packets to members and friends who did not receive those last week. Roger Clary will come forward now and speak with us about why he supports UUFM.
<We're> Well, good morning. This is a stewardship drive, and I'm going to try to cajole some of you to give a little more money, give a little more time, and do a little more work. I know that sounds awful, but I thought I'd start out by kind of telling you who I am as a UU. Now, I have been a UU for approximately 56 years. I got started with the UUs and a program called LRY, Liberal Religious Youth. Some donor gave, at that time, $250,000, which today would be millions. To start the youth groups, the Unitarian and Universalist Youth. And it turned out that Unitarian and Universalist Youth joined together as one group a year before the Unitarians and Universalist adults could get together and do the same thing. Well, I have to say, when we moved to Murfreesboro here in 2009, we did investigate the UUFM, at that time the UFM, because we needed some kind of a home. We know that Tennessee was going to be a little different than where we came from, and that we needed people that kind of thought like we did, or at least thought about something, at least thinking. And I don't know, if it wasn't for the UUFM, I would be a little more nuts. And we have lots of friends here, and we enjoy all the community here. And obviously it must be important to you. If you got up this morning and put on your clothes and came here, it's important to you. So we need to support this kind of. So, in that stead, I'm going to talk to you about something called the Pareto Principle. The Pareto Principle, also known as the 80-20 rule, okay, states that for many events, roughly 80% of the effect comes from 20% of the causes. Management consultant Joseph M. Durain suggests that the principle is named after an Italian economist, Pareto, who, while at the University of Lucerne in 1896, published his first paper. And in Italian, I can't read it. But it says that 80% of the land in Italy was owned by 20% of the people. Pareto also noticed that about 20% of the pea pods in his garden actually gave 80% of the peas. Now, in business, they use the 80-20 principle a lot. It's kind of a rule or a guide. It's kind of a joke, but it's sort of true in a lot of ways. 80% of the company's profits come from 20% of the customers. 80% of the company's complaints come from 20% of the customers. 80% of the company's profits come from 20% of the time that the staff spends. One common adage in the IT industry is that 20% of all errors, 20% of all users generally only use 20% of the software features. So you have your Microsoft Word with all these things it does. You never use most of them. Microsoft has learned that 80% of the errors and crashes in Windows Office are caused by 20% of the bug pool. So I'm going to apply the 80-20 rule to the UUFM here. We have about 40 or 45 active people. So if 80% of UUFM's income comes from 20% of the members, that's about 8 or 9 people. Okay, so 8 or 9 people are supporting the majority of the income. 80% of UUFM complaints come from 20% of its members. I can't do anything about that. 80% of the work done is also done by 20% of the members. That means we have 8 or 9 people doing this work. And so I have a little graph here of the 80-20 rule. And the green line here, the straight line, that would be if everybody worked and did everything. That would be 100% of the people do 100% of the work, and that would be perfection. Now, we're never going to get to perfection. I'm not asking for us to get to perfection. But the 80-20 rule is the cyan one here, this kind of big curve up here. It's really stretched up there. That's the 80-20 rules. I would like us to have a goal to work from an 80-20 kind of organization to a 70-30 organization. And it doesn't sound like much of a change, but it would be a lot. If we could get just 4 or 5 more people giving a little bit more cash, if we could get only 4 or 5 more people doing a little bit more of the work. And I know everybody can't do everything. Physically, some people aren't able to do things, and that's just the way it is. And some people just haven't got any more money because they just haven't got any more money. But I know a lot of us, you know, we are always buying that extra latte or whatever we're doing. We have a little extra cash we could do, or we could spend a little extra time. And that would, I suppose, lighten the load for those that have been, the 8 or 9 people that have been putting in the time and effort. And I know that's supposed to convince you to, you know, get up and do stuff. And I'm just going to say, I think it's very important that we keep this going. I would really miss this place if it wasn't here. I'd have to start it myself, and that'd really be a lot of work. So think about it. You know, when you fill out that little card there, it's got the little chart where, you know, if you think the church is okay, you give a certain percentage, and you think the church is wonderful, you give a little more. You know, it's a reasonable chart. I think it's a pretty good one to kind of cajole you into maybe doing a little bit more. So think about it. And if you haven't got the cash, think about the time and the effort, okay? And I guess that's it for Stewardship Drive. Thank you.